Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Timothy F. Geithner, 47 years old, currently the president of the New York Fed, and if what we hear is true, about to have his hands full saving the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 423 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce emissions. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It's the 21st of November today. And you know how we've been saying the last hour or so of trading has been crazy the past couple of months and that there's rarely been a single clear reason? Not so today at all. Almost the minute that NBC News reported President-elect Barack Obama will name New York Fed Chief Tim Geithner as Treasury Secretary, early next week probably, it was off to the races on Wall Street. The Dow gained 500 points in the last 2 hours. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains what all the excitement was about.
In Timothy Geithner, the Obama administration gets a fresh face and continuity. At 47, Geithner is a relative newcomer, especially compared to some Clinton administration veterans under consideration for other posts. He has advised both the Obama campaign and transition team and will represent the change the president-elect is looking for. Geithner is less of a Wall Street insider and more of an outside expert on the financial system. He brokered many of the deals that kept banks and insurance companies afloat and helped structure the $700 billion bailout. As president of the New York Fed, Geithner is already known on Wall Street, and he worked at the Clinton Treasury Department as an aide to both secretaries Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As John said, Tim Geithner's been in the thick of the bailout negotiations, right there alongside Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke. That makes this an excellent day to explore how things are going, because all of a sudden this week, it started not looking so good. Marketplace's Steve Henn is on the bailout beat.
The U.S. Treasury Department's injecting $290 billion into banks and insurance companies. The idea was this would get lending moving again, and it seemed to be working. Then this week, something changed. Charles Gabriel's at Alpha Partners. He tracks political risks for investors. He says Secretary Paulson's recent announcement that he's not going to buy toxic mortgage assets stunned Wall Street.
You have a Treasury Secretary that seems to have left the field before the end of the third quarter.
And earlier this week, Paulson told Congress he would not seek authorization to spend the remaining $350 billion in the bailout. Interest rates banks charge each other for loans spiked, and the yield on one-month Treasury bills neared zero. That means people are so desperate for a safe place to put their money, they're willing to lend it to the feds for free. Speaking around noon today, Gabriel was almost despondent.
I'm just in a state of shock.
He said the markets were horrified at the leadership vacuum in Washington.
You know, if all that the Fed and Treasury have done has failed to reestablish confidence, then you really have to worry about a total meltdown.
But Ted Truman, a former Fed economist who's now at the Peterson Institute, says there's still a lot the Fed can and should do.
Especially in this environment.
Truman says the Fed should slash interest rates to zero and pump money directly into the housing market. And there's no need to wait until Obama and his new Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, take over. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There are rumblings out there that Washington's going to need to do something more to save the economy. Yeah, the word bailout factors in here as well today, and here's why. 1 billion shares of Citigroup changed hands today, and not on the upside either. Shares in one of this country's biggest banks touched $3 today. That's crazy low, because nobody is really sure Citi's going to make it. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite tells us how things at Citigroup got so bad so fast and how they might get worse for the rest of us.
Many were surprised when Secretary Paulson announced last week that the original idea for the Troubled Asset Relief Program would be abandoned. Venture capitalist Peter Cohen says Citigroup investors were particularly disappointed because they know the bank holds many suspect loans.
I think that was one of the things that was keeping Citigroup stock up was the idea that the government was eventually going to step in and buy a bunch of the toxic waste off of the books of banks like Citigroup, and that would help Citigroup a lot.
He says when the market realized that wasn't going to happen, it kicked off the decline in Citi's stock. As for what could happen if Citigroup can't resolve its woes, Richard Marston of the Wharton School of Business says just think back a couple of months to the week that Lehman Brothers failed.
There were so many tentacles of Lehman Brothers across the world. We found later that week there was a run on money market funds. Why? Because one of the money market funds had a lot of Lehman commercial paper and decided they couldn't pay out their money.
Next thing we knew, the commercial paper market had dried up and companies were finding it hard to borrow. Jamie Peters is an equity analyst at Morningstar. She says if Citigroup went under, it would cause havoc at other financial institutions and in the economy in general.
Citigroup is a very large bank. It helps do correspondent lending with other banks. It's in every single aspect of financial services, pretty much, and it has also got such a global outreach.
It has liabilities in many countries. Peters says there will be pressure on the government, not just in the US, but in the rest of the world, not to let Citigroup fail. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
After a couple of grueling days on Capitol Hill, Detroit's big three car makers have been sent home with some work to do. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have promised to try to pull some help together after Thanksgiving. That is, if the automakers themselves can come up with a convincing argument for why they need the cash. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to explain what might be convincing enough.
You might call it a Dear Rick letter, as in GM CEO Rick Wagner, or Dear Bob, as in Chrysler's Nardelli. It's the letter Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid sent the Detroit Three today, because Pelosi says she needs some answers.
We have some problems because they keep changing the request. We want it in writing. What is it that they want it for?
That's what Marianne Keller wants to know. She's an independent auto analyst, and she says there's some very basic information any company should offer when it asks for money, whether it's a loan or an investment.
What is your forecast for the economy, for vehicle sales, for your production, for your operating profits? What are you going to use this money for?
She says it's not even about the companies building better cars. Right now, they're in so much trouble. It's just about how to pay their bills to suppliers, to workers, to everybody. But in order to get the money to pay those bills, the Detroit Three may well have to convince all those people to pitch in. Edward Lapham is executive editor of Automotive News.
The UAW members have to do it. They'll freeze pay raises inside the company, probably. Some of the top guys will work for a buck a year until the loans are paid back, or they'll work for stock options, or they'll work for something else that sort of is pegged to their performance and how well they do.
The Detroit Three may be listening. Today, GM announced it's turning in two of its corporate jets. Of course, there's always room for more cuts. For now, the company's reportedly hanging on to the remaining three. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Tim Geithner may well be the most popular man on Wall Street this afternoon, but don't go breaking out the champagne just yet, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. General Motors said today it's going to shut down some of its factories for an extra week or two this year over the winter holiday. The company's been laying off workers at plants and offices all over the country for months now, including the second shift in Shreveport, Louisiana. At the same time, the natural gas industry in that part of the state is hiring, so there are going to be jobs for some of the laid-off auto workers, if they can hack them. Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio has our story.
Chesapeake Energy is drilling 600 exploratory wells in northwest Louisiana and east Texas. It's looking for natural gas trapped in a geologic formation called the Haynesville Shale. It blipped onto energy producers' radar this year, and that could mean a gusher of jobs. Chesapeake's Kevin McCotter.
It's potentially the largest natural gas field in the United States, and we're scaling up in a major way.
McCotter says Chesapeake will hire about 700 workers to staff new drilling rigs, and as many as 2,000 other jobs could be created to support the operations. Many of those jobs are likely to go to former GM employees.
Those employees have had experience in assembly line work, working in teams, both hard and soft skills that are required for success on a drilling rig.
About 1,200 auto workers in and around Shreveport were laid off over the last 2 months. Many resurfaced at oil and gas production job fairs. Jody Neiswanger is with the Louisiana Oil and Gas Association. She's been surveying energy companies to find out what jobs they need to fill.
I think that there's going to be a lot of competition for these jobs simply because they're high-paying jobs, they're reliable jobs, and they're with reputable companies.
But rig jobs usually mean 12-hour shifts, aching backs, and workers are often required to live on site. That's not the lifestyle that Lonnie Mitchell desires. He lost his job at a GM parts supplier in September. Recently, the 48-year-old father of two applied for unemployment assistance in a room full of former coworkers also looking for help. Mitchell once worked in oil production. He used to guide heavy equipment down oil wells, and for now, it's a career he'd rather not go back to.
You on call all the time. You never know when you would come back from the oil field. Go right back out and do another job. It's not like an 8-to-5 job.
Many applicants don't have oil experience. But even if auto workers make the career leap, they're faced with a boom and bust industry, Louisiana economist Lauren Scott.
Right now, the jobs are desperately needed in the oil and gas extraction industry. But going into that, people just have to know that it is an industry that's subject to wild swings.
Right now, exploration companies are banking on an upswing in energy prices, and they hope to have workers hired, trained, and ready to drill when that happens. In Shreveport, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Today's Geithner bounce aside, this was not a week filled with joy in the markets or in the larger economy. Today on our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, we've called Felix Salmon at Portfolio.com and Andy Brooks. He's the chief trader at T. Rowe Price. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Kai.
Felix, is it just me or did things get a whole lot worse this week?
Things got a whole lot worse this week.
All right, good. Well, now that we got that figured out, what happened?
Citigroup was one of them and the automakers was the other. Put the two together and it's pretty gruesome. The government doesn't seem to have any particular inclination to bail out the automakers. It will probably bail out Citigroup if it has to, but it clearly doesn't want to because that would be enormously expensive. And the stock market is envisioning a very large number of very large companies going to zero.
Andy, we talked to you a couple of weeks ago. You said you were feeling not great, but better. Now?
Yeah, probably a touch premature, Kai. And I think if you weren't scared before, you're sort of scared now.
Let me ask you what's driving this. Felix gave us Citigroup, it gave us the car makers, so that's sort of the macro thing. But on the market day-to-day basis, what actually is happening here that's driving the market down?
Well, I think you've got all kinds of rumors that are working their way through the markets. They're certainly concerned that hedge funds are facing mass redemptions and huge selling pressure. The credit markets have gotten challenged again this week. The commercial mortgage-backed market really has taken some hits. And we don't see any good news for a while. And the Bush administration probably isn't going to do a lot here in the next few weeks, so that's putting sort of things on hold. The flip side is a touch that, market's a lot lower and valuations at some point are going to matter again. So if you've been waiting to buy some good companies, you're certainly getting your chance today.
I don't really hear you saying that this is a buying opportunity, do I?
Well, I think what I would say is it's time to step out and I would be doing some buying. And historically, you know, we've come out of these bad markets with a pretty good bounce, whether it was the Cuban Missile Crisis or the 73-74 market or the crash in 87. You know, people like to say they sold out of the market before the crash in 87. If you didn't get back in by the end of October, you severely underperformed.
Over the long term, though, Andy, how long do you think a bear market could last? Because the bull market lasted for all the way from 82 to 97. The bear market, do you think it could really be as short as a year or two?
Well, that's a great question, Felix, and that's maybe the $64,000 question. How long are we in this? How long do we tread water or go lower? I do think that all of us sense that this recession is going to last a lot longer than the normal recession.
Felix, pick up on that thing that Andy was saying about the government not being able to do anything. We're in a spot here where it's, you know, 2 more months until there's a change of administrations. What can be done?
And even then, there's very little they can do because we've already used up most of our monetary policy bullets. Our interest rate is at 1. It can maybe go down to 0.5, but then it basically has to stop. In terms of fiscal policy, you can have another stimulus plan that could throw in another $500-700 billion. But if you look at the stock market, we've lost $10 trillion in wealth. A small stimulus plan is going to be a small stimulus plan, and it will help over the course of a quarter. Anyone looking to Washington for help, whether it's the present administration or whether it's the next administration, is liable to be disappointed, as we saw this week with the hope for an automaker bailout. That didn't happen.
Let me get a gut check from both of you before I let you go. Are you feeling worse now than you did 6 weeks ago, Felix?
No, I think right now, as Andy says, valuations are so low, there has to come a point where they can't keep on dropping at this rate. So things are more likely to go up now than they were a few weeks ago.
Andy, same question.
You know, I feel worse, but that makes me, in a perverse way, feel more bullish. So I hope that's a good thing. But it's been a tough week, and I'm hard-pressed to remember a week where the mood was so ugly and so broadly felt.
Andy Brooks at T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. Felix Salmon at Portfolio.com up in New York. Felix, thanks a lot. Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, when trading slows to a trickle.
You can't divert the Mississippi River, a small stream of liquidity you can move around.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets ended with a big bang today, but there is still a whole lot of whimpering and wound licking on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials rose 494 points this Friday, 6.5%, closed at 8,046. The Nasdaq rose 68 points, just over 5%, to end the day at 1384. The S&P 500 bumped up 47 points, that is 6.3%, finished at 800 on the nose. For the week, though, deep breaths now, everybody. The Dow sheared off 5.3%, the Nasdaq gave back 8.8%. The S&P 500 forfeited 8.4%. In a tale of two retailers, Foot Locker ran down 28% today on unexpectedly weak earnings projections. Clothing retailer Gap jumped up 27%, though, thanks to some good quarterly profit numbers. Microsoft blipped up 12% as investors reacted to a report saying the company's stock was undervalued. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for October. The Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association release annual data on what shoppers think about debt and what they plan to spend this holiday season, if anything. And the Capitol Christmas tree is scheduled to arrive in the Capitol. The 70-plus foot fir is being trucked in from Montana. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Corporate America is in something of a crisis, as you know. That means meetings, lots of them. For some who sit on corporate boards, though, all that time around the table or on conference calls is getting to be too much, especially when you consider that many directors serve on more than one board or they run their own big and troubled companies. An analysis published today by the Wall Street Journal shows 42 firms have lost big-name corporate directors this year, and wouldn't you know it, they're in hard-hit industries like retail and housing and financial services. Marketplace's Renita Jablonski reports on the growing number of empty seats around the boardroom table.
Ford Motor Company has a lot to figure out right now, like how to convince the government to bail it out. Mark Truby is director of corporate communications at Ford.
the board's input and direction in times like this is very valuable.
But board members' time is valuable, too. Ford lost two high-profile directors last month, the chairman of Britain's Vodafone and the chairman of Nokia and Royal Dutch Shell.
We're asking quite a lot of our board, a lot of time and attention, and then for those directors, it would have been more international travel. So that was really what was behind their decision to resign from the Ford board.
George Davis says many outside directors are also getting heat from their own boards.
That they maintain extra focus on their own company during these turbulent times.
Davis is co-head of the Global Board Practice Group for Egan Zehnder International. He recruits corporate directors. Davis says now that the financial crisis has hit companies in every industry, it's not as easy to get top executives to sign up, especially for boards of struggling companies.
People are worried about liabilities. You know, joining a troubled company board midstream is a very difficult recruit.
Davis says boards typically meet 6 to 7 times a year.
But if you're in a troubled company board, there's going to be multiple conference calls during the week, weekend calls. I mean, you're really signing up for more than just what the average directorship would entail.
That's left some empty seats at AIG, Sprint Nextel, and other companies. And boardrooms may not be full again until the economy recovers. I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
You've heard the phrase, it ain't over till it's over, right? Well, it applies in stocks as much as it does in sports. If you think we've had some rough rides in the markets between 9:30 and 4 o'clock Eastern time, spare a thought for those who buy and sell after the closing bell. You can get an edge in after-hours trading, but it can be a brutal experience if you get it wrong. Mitchell Hartman tells us who trades after hours and why in today's installment of our explainer series, The Marketplace Decoder.
Think of the stock market as a mighty river, a river with a dam across it. At 9:30 every morning in New York, they open up the floodgates, and the stock trades rush down. Each share is like a drop of water, only there are billions of them flowing past. It's a torrent of people buying, people selling, and middlemen, specialists and market makers, bobbing along in between, setting a price. The river flows by all day, and then it's 4 o'clock in New York. A bell rings, and the floodgates close.
The volume is cut back, so it's like there's a partial dam.
University of Portland finance professor Richard Gritta.
It's not a waterfall now. It's a smaller trickle.
The trickle of extended hours trading. The riverbed's running dry, but you can still splash around in the shallows, buying and selling shares by computer for 4 more hours until 8 p.m. That's when the computer systems shut down and the day's trades are cleared. The online trading starts up again early in the morning, a few hours before the markets open. Chris Kincannon is an executive VP in the Transaction Services Group at NASDAQ. He says some investors, especially market professionals, trade in the extended hours period because they want to take advantage of news that comes out after the closing bell.
Many companies report earnings either before the market opens or after the market closes. The intrinsic value of a stock is constantly moving whether the market is open or not, and people want to access the market when the intrinsic value is changing.
But there's a big disadvantage to trading when the market's officially closed.
There's a lack of liquidity from a large segment of the client base, whether it's retail, institutional, or market makers.
There aren't many people trading, in other words, which means not many stocks change hands. Many don't trade at all. Most investors don't like those conditions. They prefer a busy market with lots of people buying and selling. That smooths out movements in share prices. If there are only a handful of people trading, stock prices can swing wildly back and forth, and that volatility makes investing riskier. Chris Kincannon likens it to dropping a rock in the river of trading. After hours, a little news can make a big splash.
You can't divert the Mississippi River. A small stream of liquidity you can move around.
Some say the solution is to simply open the floodgates full throttle and have high liquidity electronic trading 24/7. But the U.S. markets need the river to run dry every night and for trading to stop, at least for a few hours. It's the only way to sort out broker accounts and set closing values for indexes and mutual funds. Plus, traders do need to go home and get some rest before they're ready to plunge in again in the morning. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're looking for help with some of the other terms you've heard used during fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis, there are more decoders and whiteboard explainers on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution by carrying the load of 280 trucks by rail. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note today, you know, things have been pretty hectic here at Marketplace. Financial Armageddon doesn't really leave much time for things like, you know, going to happy hour on Fridays. But when a bar not far from us here in downtown L.A. started a promotion called The Soup Kitchen with 35-cent cocktails with names like Bailout and 401K and free grilled cheese sandwiches with tomato soup, well, we made some time. The Edison Bar looks a lot like I imagine a 20s-style speakeasy might. Dim lights, a couple of guys in fedoras, women in flapper dresses, and bartenders who know their jobs. Are you having one of those drinks these guys are making tonight, or are you having something else?
A bailout. It's bourbon, lemon juice, and I believe a little bit of pomegranate.
Dave Young's filling out a card that customers get when they walk in the door. It asks whether they think their 401k is half full or half empty.
You know, I think I checked half full.
Come on. Yeah. Seriously?
Yeah.
How come?
Because, I don't know, I've always been half full.
Bar manager Aiden Demarest says the gimmick of Depression-era prices really took on a life of its own once Wall Street started imploding.
That day, the day the market fell apart, was slam-packed in here. You would never have guessed that the country was broke. Drinks were flowing.
It's still early in this particular happy hour, but Marco Dominguez is one of the few not in good spirits when I ask him about his 401k.
Actually, I just scratched it off and I put empty.
Empty. Could be because he's an accountant at a law firm that works for insurance companies, including the one that the American public owns a $100 billion chunk of, AIG, of course. And that is Marketplace on this Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 494 points, 6.5% on news that Timothy Geithner might be the new Treasury Secretary. The Nasdaq gained 65 points, just under 5%. The S&P 500 added 27 points, 3.2% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yore. Coming up on Monday, big questions from one of the nation's biggest retailers.
How do you remain competitive? How do you make sure that value is a crystal clear message? But how do you represent the fashion drive that made our company successful for so many years and will continue to do that?
It's another conversation from the corner office, this time with Macy's CEO Terry Lundgren. The parade, by the way, is Thursday, in case you forgot. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.